Hello, and welcome to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg. This week, we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Thanks so much for being with us as you're listening. Remember, you can always email your questions for the mayor today and for any of our mayors to ask@wbaa.org. Good afternoon, Mayor Barton.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tail end of January, but I'm going to wish you a happy new year nonetheless.
Thank you. And we haven't spoken this year, have we?
We have not. This is our first time, so we'll make it a good one.
There you go.
So we are going to start with a quick COVID-19 update. Montgomery County, like a lot of the state right now, starting to see a decline in case numbers. And it looks like you're starting that process of transitioning out of the most serious red category. So first, what does that shift mean, or will it mean when it goes officially into effect, kind of practically speaking for the city?
Well, for the most part, that big change will be allowing larger gatherings, but I really don't see a lot of those, you know, on the horizon anyway. So I don't think you're going to see this profound flipping of the switch to some big change all of a sudden when we transition, because most groups have just decided to forego those gatherings anyway, and the other groups that are not really, you know, paying attention to that or not adhering to those guidelines, you know, on their own. So I don't think you'll see a big change, but it is noteworthy, and it is something that we're looking at, and it does affect how we approach, you know, some of our public meetings and whether or not we have, you know, in our case, city buildings open and things like that as well.
And so are you, I know that this kind of shifted over, clicked over yesterday in the Wednesday update. So just starting to have some of those conversations, or is some of that already kind of going to be taking effect?
Well, we've been having those conversations, and I think we have a solid plan, knowing that we will see some shift back and forth. I would hope that we would, you know, progress to better stages and just stay there, but I'm not naive enough to think that's the case. And certainly we've heard from our health officer that he believes that we may, you know, see a lull and things ease up, and then it might pick up again, in his estimation, in March. So we could see us regress back into those color stages and potentially even become red again. So, you know, for us, it's just having a plan, knowing that when we are red, this is our plan, and when we're yellow, this is our plan, and so on.
So I know that they're saying at this point, you mentioned your health officer talking about March. I know the thought is that it's possible that by then the predominant strains of COVID will be these variants that we keep hearing about that are more transmissible than what we've been dealing with, if not more serious once you actually get sick. Is that his thought process there?
Exactly. And, you know, and the other thought there is that really ramping up vaccine distribution is really the key here, because, you know, as was pointed out to us this morning, you don't have these mutations happening if you can and really control the infection rate, because the more people who are infected, the more likely you are to have these mutations occur. So if we can really try to, you know, dampen that and reduce those numbers of infections, that's the key. And that's where the vaccine comes in.
Can you give us an update on how that vaccination process is going in your area?
Well, I think it's going very well, and we're getting very good reports, and the state has announced they're going to increase the amount of vaccine they're sending into Montgomery County, which is a good sign. And, you know, we think it's because the vaccine site is being operated very well, and it's very efficient. That being said, at this point, it's still inadequate. There's no doubt about that, but it's based on the amount of vaccine or product that we get, you know, to administer. But I think, you know, the state outlined yesterday some big changes in the pipeline. Despite the nationwide shortage, Indiana is planning to push out more vaccine. And we've seen that. They talked about pushing it out into the pharmacies. And we're in talks with them now about some other options in our community. You know, the city of Crawfordsville is in a little different situation than even the other three mayors that you talk about in their cities, because we have a health provider component or department within city government. You know, our fire department does emergency medicine. They have a subdivision that's community health. So we are in that vaccine sphere, if you will. And so I think you're going to see in our community, you know, people are going to have options. They can go to that existing site. They'll be able to go to the pharmacies. And then there may be some options through the community paramedics at some point as more product becomes available.
And I wanted to ask about that. I know we touched on that briefly last month. And it looks like you have, you know, if I'm looking at the ISDH vaccination map site, you have one kind of official site up there at this point. And I want to say it's open 2 days during the week for 3 or 4 hours, and then maybe for a longer period on Saturdays. You know, obviously that would, and it depends on what county we're talking about. Obviously, areas with a bigger population are going to have more sites. But, you know, you did talk about that potential kind of unique situation in Crawfordsville, kind of that city-county collaboration that could be kind of different from what other people are working with.
Right.
So I guess, first of all, in terms of that particular partnership or that unique option, can you describe for us, you know, what does that look like if the paramedics are becoming involved, if that becomes part of like the vaccination pipeline? You know, what would that scenario look like?
Well, I think the most accurate answer right now is I'm not entirely sure.
Okay.
But we are playing through, we've been asked to really play through basically three different scenarios. And our people are working on that right now. And that could be a combination of, I mean, right now we currently are supplying some of our paramedics into the existing site.
Okay.
I know they're doing like the observation period after the injection to make sure someone doesn't have a reaction or an anaphylactic reaction. And if they do, we have highly trained people there. But then, so there's that piece. There's also, we currently operate a drive-through testing site that could be converted into drive-through vaccinations. That has not been done a lot in Indiana. It's been done some. It's been done very successfully in other states. And there's an interest on the states of Indiana's part to really create a model to show how that works. And so that's one possibility. And then there's what's called a pod or point of dispensing, in which, you know, we would actually be going out and setting up, you know, and let's say go to a different industries, different schools, different places like that, where you actually bring the vaccine to people. And that's an interesting concept. And I think that's one that we'll be working with as well. You know, and I'm not talking about in the next week. I'm talking in the coming months as supply becomes available. So we're working through all those scenarios. And what I think you'll end up seeing, this is my guess, is probably a combination of all of those.
Okay. You gave your annual State of the City address this week. So I wanted to spend some time talking about that today. First of all, as you pointed out, last year you gave this yearly address to a full room of people. That obviously didn't happen this year. You talked
right.
about how everything that's happened has been unprecedented. You said to the point that maybe we've become numb to that word.
We have, yeah.
And so I just wanted to point out two things you said about how you've handled the pandemic and your community that particularly struck me. First, you talked about you called it a truly humble respect for the authority that has been entrusted in me. I guess, can you talk about that authority
right.
and the weight of that?
Well, when you place, in our case, the city under a public health emergency, one thing you're very well aware of is that it does give the chief executive officer a tremendous amount of power. I mean, there's just no other way to describe that. You can do things unilaterally without really involving the legislative branch. You can make those decisions and make things happen. And I think, you know, with that comes a tremendous responsibility. And I feel like, you know, sometimes elected officials, they'll take advantage of that to a certain degree to get some things done they want to get done. And I pledged that I was going to really respect that and certainly have that tool available. And there were times that I had to make decisions that couldn't wait on the process, and we made them and made things happen. But everything we've done to date, I've gone back and had validated through the official processes. So it's gone back to the city council. If I approved an expenditure, it went back to them. It might've been 2 months later, but it went back. But for me, just having a respect of, you know, this is a tremendous amount of authority and power to be able to do these things through executive order. And I don't want to abuse it. I want to be very careful with it and very thoughtful in my approach to applying this. And I'm not convinced that that's been the case, you know, in government all across the U.S. I mean, some people have done very well, and I think others have probably taken that a little bit too far. So that's what I was speaking to there.
So you also talked about how you, I guess, hoped history would look back on your approach to all of this. How have you thought about that aspect of these past months? I guess how future generations might look back and weigh your legacy at this moment and the decisions you've made, and perhaps even question some of those decisions.
Well, for sure, then they say hindsight is 2020, and I do think we have a responsibility in going through this to not only think about how we maneuver ourselves through this today, but how do we prepare for this to happen in the future? Because it will happen again, and maybe not in our lifetimes, but we're certainly, I think, become the testing ground for what works and doesn't work. And I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. And I think certainly we've made some mistakes. We've gotten some things right. Overall, our approach has been good. But I hope we're creating a model for the future to learn from. And I do think a lot about what history is going to think, looking back on how we've approached this. And I think there's going to be some surprises in there because, I heard an oncologist speak yesterday that cancer screenings have been down 75%. Well, if you think about the long-term implications healthcare-wise of that, it's going to be pretty profound in another year or two. And I have very strong feelings about, education. That's not something that's directly under, my authority. I'm not the school superintendent, but I think we are, teetering with doing irreparable damage to these children from an academic standpoint that they're not going to recover from. And we have to weigh those decisions out. And there are no easy answers. I'm not criticizing the schools for the decisions they've made. I'm just saying, I think in hindsight, down the road, history's going to look back and say, wow, look at the implications health-wise or educationally that we did with some of the actions that were taken at the time.
You are listening to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg, and right now we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Mayor, you spent some time talking about Crawfordsville's investment in solar energy. So first, explain for us baseline, where things are at and what the city's working with and has physically implemented around that so far.
Well, in our case, I mean, we're a member of IMPA, and IMPA has done the direct investment, but we certainly created the environment that enticed that investment to come to Crawfordsville, knowing that, we were going to be better off if we had more renewable in our mixture here, for several reasons. Obviously, it's better for the environment, but it also offsets what we pull from the grid because the power produced here in our solar grid is used here. And that means we're pulling less power off the grid. And when you look at those numbers, the power that you pull from the grid, there's a lot of built in there, those transmission fees and things like that, that we can just totally avoid if we're just producing power here. And then there's the long-term investment in those properties and what that means to the assessed value of our community and the tax base down the road. So we've worked very hard, and we're now in a situation where half of our normal daily load comes from solar. And I think that's remarkable for a community our size in Indiana to say that we're getting half our power from a renewable source. We quickly figured out in that scenario that not every community was going to aggressively pursue this and make this happen. So as IMPA looked to invest in solar, we were always at the ready when a community stumbled or didn't come through. They knew they could bring it to Crawfordsville and we would make it work. So and we're still talking about additional solar capacity down the road.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are your plans for expansion in the future?
Well, we're in talks with them right now, and they have an interest. The really key factor is really finding suitable property. Obviously, you don't want to take prime land out of service, for other things to put in solar. And then it also has to be geographically located on our system. You can't have all your solar feeding into one, sector, if you will. You have to spread that around. So right now, the west side of the city is our area that we need more solar capacity, where we could use it, if you will. So we're talking with them right now and looking at property. You have to get the property at the right price to make the numbers work. So I think you'll see some more happen here, but we just have to work through that process.
You also highlighted the Crawfordsville Airport, and you said, you know, two things of note here in terms of its success over the last year. You said there was an increase in jet fuel sales of 29%. And then what sounds like a pretty significant increase in the number of flights coming through the airport, or as you put it, an operation, which, as you also pointed out, you know, these increases are maybe even more notable when we're talking about a year in which air travel decreased. What are you attributing this uptick to? You know, where is this coming from?
Right. Well, we had to find our niche, and we've worked very hard at that. And what we've seen is that our corporate traffic is actually down, which is very worrisome, but that's happened across the board everywhere. People, you know, in the corporate world are just not traveling. They're having virtual meetings and so on. We seem to have found our niche in really becoming a destination for flight instruction. So we've partnered with some of the major flight schools, and as they fly into Crawfordsville, and that's where they stop and they acquire fuel. We've created an environment with our terminal that's very, very inviting to them and very comfortable for them, knowing that if you please the customer, they'll come back. And that's exactly what's happened with our airport. So the numbers of takeoff and landings, the numbers of the amount of jet fuel sales, those are all directly tied to the flight instruction schools using our airport more and more frequently.
I want to say you said that you had been averaging around, I want to say it was between 5,000 and 9,000 operations,
right.
And then
right.
it went up to 23,000,
yes.
Something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
yeah.
Dramatic.
Dramatic. And so, you know, how did, as you were looking at this increase, at what point did you realize why this was happening? And then I guess maybe pivot to kind of start catering to that
right.
to that group of people.
This goes back a couple of years where we saw an opportunity to capitalize on the flight instruction part. And you know, it took some buy-in from the aviation board and everybody to get them to understand that, you know, this is not merely just these aircraft coming in, doing a touch and go and leaving. If we get them to come in and stop, they're going to buy fuel. And we had to negotiate contracts with those schools. I mean, they're not going to just, you know, buy fuel anywhere. And it's just getting that buy-in. But this goes back really a couple of years when we saw them occasionally come in and we saw that there was a potential niche there. And keeping in mind that flight schools are up quite a bit because there was a big demand for pilots, you know, and that may have changed with the pandemic. I'm not sure. But they were seeing retirements, you know, at very high rates, and they were trying to train young people to be pilots and not just learn to fly, but, you know, get their commercial ratings and all those kinds of things.
So more broadly, is it still a goal for the airport to continue to attract that corporate client and people who are, you know, the leisure and recreation, I believe you put it, to not just cater to this one group, but to continue to broaden that out, so multiple groups are using the airport.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we're small enough that we have to you know, try to appeal to all those groups, and all those groups comprise what we do. And there may come a time that the flight instruction piece backs off, and you know, we're trying to focus on something else. We have to meet all those demands right now, and we're confident the corporate traffic will pick back up when the pandemic's over, and we'll see good traffic there. I was actually looking this morning, the number of takeoff and landings already today was pretty high, and there's already been some corporate traffic in and out today as well. So that'll come back, and we just have to, you know, be a good general aviation airport.
How does having this type of airport help you, I guess, market Crawfordsville?
Well, it's an important gateway to our community, and what we've discovered is it's important to our existing businesses. Not even, you know, maybe even some cases they themselves don't use corporate aircraft, but a lot of their customers do. And for their customer to be able to come in, do their business, and get back on the aircraft and go home is critically important. And you know, some of our larger employers, they have traffic in and out of there quite a bit because they move their people around. They can come in, meet, look at something, and again, get on the aircraft and go back home. So it's really important that we transitioned a few years ago from municipal airport to a regional airport. with the runway extension and things like that. So we can handle fairly decent sized aircraft now.
I wanted to ask you about what you called in your address a very unique problem in Crawfordsville, the impact of high bank erosion along Sugar Creek. I was looking at a map of the creek this morning to kind of see where it winds through the city, and it's a tributary of the Wabash. So first of all, Mayor, lay out for us, what is high bank erosion? What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly as it sounds. But the geology here, when you have these high cliffs, if you will, and the creek cutting through there, you'll start to get, you know, where the creek is shifting. And what we found in the data was that with these very large rainfall events that we've had in the last 10, 15 years, on top of the fact that more farmers have put, you know, drainage systems in their fields. So you get more water in the creek more quickly, and it has sped up the process. But we have two neighborhoods in which this erosion is happening, and the bank is actually falling down into the creek. As that occurs, it continues to move further and further out, and it's people are losing their yards. They're, you know, and it's in one case we've lost an entire house a few years ago. But we have some other neighborhoods that it's creeping up on homes. I know of one home where the deck is kind of at the edge right now, so the home is next. We have struggled with this for many, many years, trying to find a solution, and have had no luck. And finally, I think we've kind of cracked this a little bit, engaged an engineering firm to do a study of what was happening and how far is this going to go, you know. Mm-hmm. And what we found was they think they can predict how far to go before it stops eroding. It's more difficult to nail down the timeline because some years you have a lot more rainfall than others, but we have a pretty good sense of that. And then we found some potential grant funding that could help identify or help address this. And it's not going to change the problem. What's happening is happening. The geologists tell us you're not going to change that trajectory, but what you can do is mitigate the risk by buying these properties so that people, you know, they don't lose their home and all the value, and getting everybody out of harm's way and just setting that land aside and let the creek do what the creek does.
So what would be the funding comes through, what's the timeline for that kind of moving people out of the way to let Sugar Creek do what it's going to do?
It's federal funding through the state. So that tells you it's a slow process. It just plays out over several years, and we've applied. We are applying in thirds, so we're not applying to do everything all at once. The engineering firm has identified which properties are in the red zone, more at risk, and then yellow, and you know, so on. So we've applied for those red properties. But even if we're successful in getting them funded, that'll still play out over 2 to 3 years.
Okay. How many people does that impact? How many properties are in the red zone?
Well, it's not a lot. I mean, you're talking about a half a dozen probably in the red zone, and it's two different neighborhoods in our community. And that's the interesting thing. When you talk about this in Crawfordsville, most people just look at you like they have no idea what you're talking about because it doesn't affect most people. It only affects the people in those two neighborhoods, and it has profound implications for them, but to everybody else, they don't even know what you're talking about. So it's not a lot of people, but those who are affected, if you can imagine living in a home, you know, and investing in it your entire life, and you're ready to retire, and now the property is falling in the creek, that's devastating.
Yeah, that the stakes are definitely high.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, it's tough in local government. Do we have an obligation to help figure this out? And I don't think we can solve everything, but we certainly have an obligation to help, and that's what we're trying to do here.
You also, it sounds like, did get funding to remove this term was new to me, a low head dam later on this year. But can you talk about that removal? What does that mean precisely?
Right. So there's a what's called a low head dam near our former power plant, which is basically Sugar Creek at US 231. You can, mm-hmm. if you look off the bridge, you can see it. These dams are not very tall, like 4 feet. They just pool the water. And initially was used for cooling at the power plant. It's been obsolete for a long time. And the dam just remains there. And so what we've done, we've known for a long time that this really probably should come out. Friends of Sugar Creek, a very active group here locally, has been pushing for this removal for a while. They've been lobbying and trying to make it happen. We engaged an ecologist and some biologists to help us understand you know, what impact would this have on the ecology of the creek, the biology of the creek? And the big question is, what kind of contamination is around the dam? Is there contamination, you know, up against the dam that we would disturb by removing it?
Okay.
So we've done all those studies, and those all came back okay. And DNR has funded to actually have that removed. And what we're after there is to, one, improve the ecology of the creek, remove that barrier. But number two, and probably more importantly to me, is the public safety aspect. These types of dams are notoriously dangerous. They are very, very dangerous because people underestimate them, and they get caught in this undertow that they can't escape. And
are people walking out a, you know, I was looking at a picture. Are they walking out across the dam?
They walk out there to fish. Okay. And here you have, you know, companies operating canoe trips and kayak trips. So there's clear signage telling people they have to portage around this, but sometimes people don't follow that and they get caught. So our fire department here performs several rescues a year. People get stuck in this dam. And what I said in my address was, you know, in recent years, those have all had successful positive outcomes, and we're probably pushing our luck there. And so this needs to come out. And so we've partnered with Friends of Sugar Creek to make that happen. And, you know, the big question, like I said, was the, you know, potential for contamination. And what we found was there was no difference upstream or downstream from the dam. So removing the dam would not have any impact on that. And that makes sense because when there's heavy rainfall, the creek floods, that dam's really hardly a factor. You know, everything's just flowing and going everywhere.
Right. I guess, technically speaking, how does one remove a dam? What actually happens for them to do that?
From my perspective, you hire the professionals.
My understanding is
they will wait till fall, late summer, fall, when the creek levels are low. And I think what they do is they come in and they open up one side of it to relieve the pressure, and then they just start working back from there. So I've been in several meetings, and I know there's different ways to do it. And, you know, the professionals that are hired will have to decide what's best here, how best to approach it in this particular situation.
Mayor, kind of in our final minute here, you talked about a new program in its early stages, the Crawfordsville Fire Department will be working on, addressing the issue of a lag in child immunizations,
right.
Something that's also been impacted by COVID. Just quickly, what can you tell us right now about that program?
Well, we're very excited that the Indiana State Department of Health reached out to us because we partner with them on several things and have created several programs that could be replicated. And this is one of them. They know they have a problem in Indiana with childhood immunizations, and it's been made much, much worse by the pandemic because children are not getting in for their well child visits, if you will. And the data is there. So this program will have our community paramedics out there, you know, able to administer these vaccines when parents consent. And that's going to be huge, absolutely huge.
That is our time for today. Mayor Barton, thanks as always for
being
with us. You can find this program on our website, WBAA.org, along with an archive of our shows with the mayors of Lafayette, West Lafayette, Crawfordsville, and Frankfort. Send us your questions to ask, that's ASK, at WBAA.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great rest of the day.